Accession number 32297, reel 20.
John Dixon, reel 20.
Right, if I could just recap a little bit. When we formed our squadron, 812 Naval Air Squadron, we started off with 12 Barracudas, and we were a very close-knit band, as I think you probably gathered. Over the next few months, the squadron increased in size. We got to being a 16-aircraft squadron. And then just about the time, or just before we joined HMS Vengeance, we were actually an 18-aircraft squadron. Now, this changed things a little bit because obviously we had extra crews coming in. The hard core, the nucleus of we older ones, of course, were still very much centre stage, and these other people were coming in. Some, quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, they're just names on a piece of paper. Some didn't stay. Maybe they weren't up to scratch, or I don't know, but there were various odd bods who were supposedly part of our squadron that didn't seem to become involved with the rest of us. So that was as we were when we joined HMS Vengeance. I didn't mention when we were up at Ferne that we'd actually done our first stint of night dive bombing, which is quite something to think about these days, but we'll probably come on to that a bit later on. But it was that was one exercise we did, and we practiced an awful lot of anti-submarine bombing, which I don't think we mentioned before. A lot of my logbook says anti-submarine bombing exercises, which were not so exciting, but obviously formed quite a bit of our working up period.
What did that involve then? How did you?
Well, you either had a moving target or a stationary target, which was a buoy or something floating out at sea, and you dived on it at a very shallow sort of angle, and you had a stick of four practice bombs. They would be depth charges in the real world, but these were four practice bombs, and the idea was that you tried to straddle the target. I mean, ideally you would get two bombs one side and two the other side, and then real depth charges, of course, would explode and would compress the hull of the submarine, and you got quite good at it. We did eventually move on to a moving target. We didn't have a submarine to play with, obviously, but a ship went out and towed something behind it, and we had to sort of try and hit a moving target. But we did that. We did it by day and we did it by night. At night time, of course, you drop flares and illuminated the target that way. But it features in my logbook many, many times, anti-submarine bombing. We didn't put exercise every time, but obviously it was exercising. On a personal front, I'd particularly chummed up with another pilot in the squadron, a chap called Jackie Birch, or Jack, who was one of the lads who had originally trained in America, but he was a super bloke. And he and I shared a great love of classical music. And I well remember when we were at Bursko, he and I managed to wangle tickets into Southport to listen to the Halley Orchestra with Sir John Barbarolli. And that was a bit of a highlight when you're just 19 years old. When we were up at Ferne, by the way, I achieved my 20th birthday. And stopped being a midshipman and very proudly wore the sub-lieutenant's wavy stripe, which put me on a par with everybody else, and a bit above Bambi, my observer, of course.
So I think we talked before about you joining Vengeance and how the carrier operated while you was working up.
Yeah.
When did you sail for...
Well, there was a hiatus. It was a shame. We joined the ship at the end of January, 25th of January, I think it was, 1945, and we really thought then we were the bee's knees. Here we were, a fully worked up squadron, embarked on our own ship, Let's get off to the war, lads. That was the sort of feeling that we had. But it didn't work that way. There was a 6 weeks period when things obviously weren't quite right. Now, whether it was the ship had still got odds and things, odds and ends that needed tidying up, whether it was to do with the other squadron's aircraft, I've no idea. But we had a 6 weeks period where morale did sink a bit, because some of us were ashore at Ayr, some went back to Ballyhalbert, and we seemed to be all over the place with no real understanding as to when we were going to be back together again. Some of the time we were on the ship. I mean, officially we were embarked, but let's assume that the ship had work to do, didn't need all the aircraft in the way, so we flew off to wherever we could go. And at that time, I think it was probably during the beginning of February, Jack Birch and I were selected to go down to Derby to Rolls-Royce to do an engine handling course. Now, we'd been flying behind Rolls-Royce Merlin engines for over six months, so we thought we knew all of us knew about the Merlin engine. But anyway, it was a bit of a lovely little break. We went down by train, Jack and I, and we had sleepers. I remember that. Oh dear, very posh. And we went down to Highton near Liverpool, where Jack lived. We broke our journey there, met his mum and dad and his girlfriends, and then we went on to Derby. We were accommodated in great luxury in the Mark Heaton Hotel. I well remember this. We had lectures in the day by the superintending engineers, all wearing white coats. We must have learned quite a bit about how Rolls-Royce Merlin engines worked and all the little intricacies. It was a very interesting course. We were only there for a week. In the evenings we used to go dancing at the Plaza. I remember that dance hall. Very pretty girls they had up there, I remember, but sadly we weren't there long enough to develop any long-term relationships. Anyway, back to the ship by train, arrived in Glasgow at the crack of dawn, and eventually got back on board by lighter. We found a lighter to take us back on board. Towards the end of February, our sister squadron, the Corsairs, of 1850 squadron, who were going to be our shipmates for the rest of the cruise or the voyage, they arrived. Now they're pretty hot American fighters, American built fighters, a bit difficult to deck land, so we understood. And so when they arrived, there was a huge crowd goofing, just waiting to see if any accidents happened. They didn't. I think they all made it as we did. Their first effort at landing on the ship was pretty good. They had done deck landings before, not like us. They'd been practicing elsewhere. In fact, I think they'd practiced on our sister ship, Venerable. They arrived, and we were all a very happy band of brothers. By this time, you can imagine with, I think we probably had 20 crews, which would have meant something like 40 officers, and they would have had, I think they had 20 aircraft in their squadron, so there would have been at least 20 of them. So you can imagine that the wardroom suddenly became completely dominated by aviators, where the regular ship's officers, of course, had to then take a bit of a back seat. And we weren't always entirely popular, but it bedded down.
So at that point when they arrived, is that when you really thought, this is it, we're going to go now?
Well, we still didn't know. I mean, we were ready and they were ready. And it was the 12th of March that we finally sailed away from the UK. We didn't know where we were going. All we knew was that the war was still on, and we were going to take part in it, presumably. There were two other carriers came with us. There was Venerable and Colossus. They were our sister ships. They each had the same setup, one Barracuda squadron, one Corsair squadron. So we were a pretty formidable striking force, if ever we'd found anything to strike. But we sailed away down through the Bay of Biscay, and although we didn't know it at the time, of course, the war in Europe was within a couple of months of coming to an end. But I mean, we knew we were winning, but we didn't know it was that close to being in. And we were on the way down. There was a submarine scare. Now, there couldn't have been too many U-boats still floating about out there, but there were, obviously, because by that time we'd occupied the their bases in northwest France. But anyway, there was supposed to be submarines, and they were a threat to our fleet, because we were quite a big fleet, as you can imagine. So 812 squadron suddenly became operational after, what, 9 months, and we flew off to do some anti-submarine patrols. I don't think the other two carriers did fly off any Barracudas, but that I can't remember. But we certainly flew one or two sorties looking for submarines. Nobody found any submarines, because I don't suppose there were any, but we had to look, didn't we? But the weather was pretty grim. It was very, the visibility was poor. I thought it was a bit hard on Jack Birch and his crew. They did their patrol. When they got back to where the fleet was supposed to be, according to Dave Robbins, who was the navigator, the observer, there was nothing to be seen. There was just an empty ocean. And when you're getting fairly low on petrol, it's the last thing you want. So they did exactly the right thing. They instituted a square search, which just meant flying like a box pattern, ever widening until you finally saw something, which was exactly the drill that you'd been taught, because there was no radio contact. I mean, everything was radio silence, of course. So this is what they did, and fortunately, in due course, there was a carrier. So Jack, very relieved, obviously makes his approach to the carrier, only to discover that the deck was all cluttered up with aircraft, and no way could he possibly land on it. And then he twigged the fact that it wasn't his ship, it wasn't Vengeance. In fact, it was Venerable that he was trying to land on. He was making his approach. Anyway, they were signalled by Aldis lamp, a flashing lamp, directing them to Vengeance, which wasn't that far away, but it was outside visual range. So Jack eventually gets back and lands on quite happily, you know, quite naturally feeling very pleased with himself that he'd done the right thing, his aircraft was safe, his crew were safe, etc., etc. But he got a rocket. He got an awful rocket, because he hadn't found his ship immediately, and B, that he sort of upset the other carrier because they thought he was in all sorts of trouble when he really wasn't in that much trouble. So he wasn't complimented, and he always felt that was a bit hard. Anyway. There was no other scares. After a few days, we anchored off Gibraltar, The only momentous thing there, we didn't go ashore. There was no time to go ashore in Gibraltar. Well, not that there would have been much point in going ashore. So we all sat out there in the harbour and looked at the Rock of Gibraltar, which was, of course, quite famous. And there we are. The memorable thing was that for the first time ever, we then had to put our white cap covers on. Because we were going into what was called summer rig. But that was the only concession we made, was to put white cat covers on. And we all felt we were we were quite smart then. So after we, I don't think we stayed there more than a day, on we went, and a couple of days later we flew off the ship to Malta. To the Royal Naval Air Station, HAL FAR, H-A-L, capital F-A-R, which was a famous Royal Naval Air Station, HMS Falcon it's called. I don't know whether it was then, but it is now, or was, post-war anyway. And this is situated down on the southwest corner of Malta. Malta, as you know, is not very big. And I think there were three airfields on it. Two belonged to the RAF, and HAL FAR was the naval one. So we flew off the ship. I think we were accelerated off, or some of us were, we were absolutely thrilled. Malta was, the bad days were over. The Italians, in fact, had surrendered in 1943, September 1943, so there was no, we weren't under any threat, really, from any enemy. So it was a nice, comfortable place to be. And I remember the wardroom there, which was sort of up on a slight rise, was a pre-war. It was originally an RAF airfield, and it was built by the RAF in the 1930s. So the wardroom was very, very comfortable. There were lots of Maltese stewards all in little white coats to wait on us. And food was pretty plentiful. Altogether, it was a very happy, pleasant place to be.
With that, did you fly off prior to the carriers arriving in Malta? Is that how you would do things when you got to?
Yeah, the idea was that, it all depended on the programme for the ship. I mean, what was the ship needing to do? If the ship was merely just going to reprovision, then we all stayed on board. And we just stayed in harbour for as long as it took to reprovision the ship, change any personnel and that sort of thing. But if the ship, as in this case, I believe she went back to Gibraltar while we were in Malta, again, maybe some technical problems, we didn't know, but nobody even told us where the ship was going. But we think she did go back to Malta for a short period. We were in Malta for 2 months, nearly 3 months, as it turned out. Again, we could have been desperately bored because we'd done all our working up, and we were only going over the same routines again, or I'll come on to something else in just a sec. But it was a very pleasant place to be in where we now, sort of March, April, May, nice spring, warm weather. I think we managed a bit of swimming. We certainly did some sailing, and it was all quite relaxed. But there were one or two quite momentous things happen. Almost as soon as we got there, we were all summoned. Cedric, our CO, got us all together. And he'd received instructions from their lordships at the Admiralty, presumably, to say that we could forget all that we'd learned about torpedo attacks. So there was 9 months' hard work suddenly told it wasn't relevant anymore. We were told that the reason was that there were no more enemy ships left that would be worth the risk of trying to torpedo them. So that was when you think of the hours and hours and hours that have been spent and in pretty dangerous sort of flying to achieve these standards that we've got to be told, forget all about it, you're not going to be using torpedoes anymore. So what were we going to do? Well, we told that the way we would operate would now be purely as dive bombers. And the Barracuda was a good dive bomber. I mean, you can't get away from it. It was a good dive bomber. Just going back in April of 1944, I think four squadrons attacked the Tirpitz in Norway, and they achieved 11 direct hits, dive bombing the Tirpitz on the first attack. The sad thing, of course, is that Barracudas couldn't carry anything bigger than a 1,600-pound bomb, so no way were you ever going to sink a ship of that size, but at least the Tirpitz was kept in harbour while they repaired her, and she was kept out of harm's way while D-Day took place. So it was a big feather in the cap for the Fleet Air Arm and for the Barracuda, really. But that was dive bombing. Now, just going on from that, as I think you gathered, that Cedric Cox, now CO, was a very force-on sort of character. He didn't let grass grow under his feet. Having been told that we were going to concentrate on dive bombing, he said, right, and he said, well, we'll do all our dive bombing at night, which was something that hadn't really been tried very much, I think, up to then, certainly not with Barracudas.
Because all your training had been in daytime, hadn't it, with the dive bombing?
Yeah, except that one trip that we'd done up at Fern. I think we had done one, according to my log, but can't remember much about it. But we now concentrated on dive bombing at night.
And I assume that would have been against land targets, wouldn't it, now, with the ship target?
No, initially we tried our initial attacks on a towed target. Yes, you're quite right. I mean, as the war in the Pacific went on, it was pretty obvious that had we ever got involved, we would have been dive bombing land targets, I'm pretty certain. Well, there wouldn't have been much else to attack. But I like to think that that's as we would have operated, probably bombing enemy airfields or whatever at night, with dive bombing. And it was quite good fun, really.
So did he set out a programme then for you to practice dive bombing?
Oh, yes, he did. We had this... I don't think I mentioned it, but we had a tame Italian destroyer. As I've mentioned, they were now neutral. I don't know whether they were officially classified as our allies, I don't know, but we had the use of an Italian destroyer that operated in and out of Grand Harbour, Valletta, Malta, and she used to go out, and we used her as a target ship. If we weren't actually going to drop anything, but if we were going to drop practice bombs, she towed a target behind her, and that's what we attacked. One of our observers, Gordon Wallace, who was a senior, he was detailed to go out on the ship to liaise with the Italian crew to tell them what to do, and to give us the right signals, usually by Morse flashing at us, you know, to attack the target when it was ready. But he used to tell lovely stories, because he said he couldn't speak any Italian and the Italians couldn't speak any English, but they had a mutual love of Chianti, so the trips used to be fairly chaotic, and I think they had been imbibing quite a lot. And suddenly realised that there was a squadron of barracudas floating about above needing a target. But that was that. The ship, this Italian destroyer, I can't possibly remember its name, was also used when we were given, I can't remember, a week or 10 days leave in two sections, a squadron, and we were sailed away to Sicily, to Taormina, which of course is a well-known resort in the Mediterranean, and we were allowed to live it up for 10 days or whatever we were there. There was no currency worth anything. The Italian lira was completely worthless. So everything was bought with cigarettes. And we used to take duty-free cigarettes with us, and that was used as currency. We were billeted. That's not quite the word, is it? Billeted? No, we were entertained is probably better. In the San Domenico Hotel, which I believe still exists. It's one of the top hotels in Sicily. All marble floors and fountains and all quite posh. And it had been, up until fairly recently, the headquarters of General Kesselring, who was the boss of the German air forces in the Mediterranean. So it was quite an upmarket establishment, and we just spent our time swimming and eating ice cream. There were various dances organised, and I don't know where the ladies came from, but they seemed to appear, and it was good fun. The funny story is that, as I said, we had everything we needed, we paid for in cigarettes. And believe it or not, they actually gave us a free issue of 20 cigarettes every day in the hotel, whether you wanted them or not. I didn't smoke, so I mean, but you still had the cigarettes given to you. And of course, 20 cigarettes would buy you a meal or whatever, you know, it was quite something. Now our air gunners, because they didn't live in a wardroom, they didn't have access to the duty-free cigarettes that we had. We were able to take 2,000, 4,000 cigarettes ashore. They didn't. They couldn't do that. So one chap decided that he wasn't ever going to need his lovely Irving jacket, you know, beautiful Irving. So he flogged that on the black market in Sicily. And he suddenly became a millionaire in terms of cigarettes. And everybody was borrowing cigarettes off him to keep their lifestyle going. But I don't know whether how he ever wrote this off his charge, but he certainly got rid of his Irving jacket.